Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me, as always, Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. Matt, you know where there's baseball on TV, like, tomorrow. I'm excited about this.
There's actually, on MLB.com, there was a stream today of the Phillies' University of Tampa game.
Really? Okay.
So there's, like, I think the Phillies, their lineup, it's all their top prospects. It's, like, according to Pipeline, it's, like, 1, 3, 4... like 7, 9, and 11 are all in the Phillies lineup tonight. So if you really want to watch some baseball and see some exciting young players, J.P. Crawford, Roman Quinn, Dylan Cousins, today's the day.
Yesterday, it wasn't on TV, but the Diamondbacks played Grand Canyon University, and it was at a StatCast field, so we got data from that. So I got to see spin rates and exit velocities from guys I'd literally never heard of before, and I was just entirely too excited about all of that. So we've got a fun show today. We've got a couple things we want to talk about. We're going to talk about what the value of Eric Hosmer is. We're going to talk about Dellin Betances arbitration controversy and how to maybe fix arbitration. And we're going to talk about kind of a new way of thinking about starting pitching depth, kind of a rethinking of just the way it's been for the entirety of baseball. First, I think we have to get to Eric Hosmer because that's kind of been in the news lately. Reports that he wants a 10-year contract next year. Now, he refutes that, but, you know, it was from Ken Rosenthal, I believe, who's a very respected reporter. Eric Hosmer has one more year left before free agency, and I think the perception of Eric Hosmer's value versus maybe the data-based perception of Eric Hosmer's value is wildly different. Would you agree with that?
To a degree, yes. He's certainly someone that, like, you know, based on kind of certainly traditional stats, and, you know, we had 100 RBIs last year, despite, you know, it was like one of the lowest, like, OPS pluses ever for a 100 RBI season. The, you know, traditional stats, he has had some good seasons, and also he kind of passed the eye test. He's been on a couple winning teams. He was a really high draft pick. So there's a lot of things that kind of, like, elevate his stature. But I'm still not convinced that there's going to be a huge market for him next year when he's a free agent.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in his favor is that the first base market next winter is pretty lousy. I mean, Carlos Santana is probably the best, but he's several years older. But if you look at Hosmer, his career so far, 335 on base, 428 slugging percentage. So that's a 107 weighted runs created plus, where 100 is league average. So he's basically been a league average hitter or slightly above. But compared to first baseman, you know, the bar is a little bit higher there. So I looked at some guys maybe he would compare to in the past. And the one that really stands out to me, James Loney. Through their age 26 season, the stat lines are almost identical. Weighted runs created plus for Hosmer, 107. For James Loney, it was 108. And really, James Loney did not turn into a guy who, you know, he's bounced around a lot.
Yeah, it's, you know, the profiles are pretty similar. You know, high school, drafted as high school first baseman, which is a profile that usually doesn't turn out that well, because basically, you, to be a productive major league first baseman, you have to hit for power. And it's hard to project power on. Oh, and it's harder to project power on high school kids.
Yeah, well, you have to hit for power, like you said, but you also, if you don't hit for power, you need to make a lot of contact.
Exactly, that's
and
what I'm saying.
And his contact has gone down the last
years. Yeah, so the Loney comp, it makes a lot of sense, because their profiles just across their entire careers have been very similar. And, you know, if you're not hitting for power, it's really hard to be valuable as a first baseman.
I like to compare him also to Brandon Belt, who I think is extremely underrated. If you look at the last three seasons of Hosmer versus Belt, Belt blows him away in pretty much every category. On-base percentage, Belt beats him out 365 to 338. Slugging percentage, 471 to 432. He's got triple the wins above replacement. And Belt signed a six-year, $79 million extension. Now, two of those years were not true free agent years. They bought at arbitration years. But what he did get was $64 million over his four free agent years. And I think that sounds about right to me. If Hosmer has another similar year, like, that's, he'll probably get more than that, but I think that seems about what you might expect. Nothing like crazy 10 years, $200 million, right? And that's kind of in the ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that that Hosmer sort of has going for him relative to other first basemen, and it's a small thing, but sort of makes him interesting in my mind, as we revealed last year on StatCast, is that he's maybe the fastest first baseman. Maybe Paul Goldschmidt probably is a more effective base runner. But
more effective in terms of lead distance. But yeah, you're right. Last year, I believe it was opening day, because I remember the Mets were there. Eric Hosmer got down the line from home to first in 3.92 seconds. And that was, at the time, the fastest that any first baseman had done in StatCast history. And I looked it up this morning. That was his fastest of the year. It was opening day, and he never beat that for the rest of the year.
He was excited, I guess, for baseball to be starting. So, you know, I think 4 for 64 might be a little generous, to be honest.
Right.
Like, I mean, like, Mark Trumbo is a good example. Like, people are like, oh, Mark Trumbo, he leads the league in home runs. Man, like, there's going to be a market for him. But teams are smarter. They understand these limited players and what they're actually worth. So for that same reason, I think that, You know, certainly if he has a season like he had last year, he'll get in the Trumbo territory. If he repeats, kind of goes back to 2015 when he was a little bit better across the board, then maybe you'll see the 4 for 64, 5 for 75.
He will be the most divisive free agent, and I think I'll be interested to see. I don't really expect the Royals to have a great season this year. Does he get traded at the end of the trade deadline?
The one thing about I wonder about Hosmer is, you know, that park is not conducive to power at all. And I don't, you know, I think that I do wonder if he's the kind of hitter, if you put him in a park where suddenly his pull power might be rewarded, if he could become, you know, when Curtis Granderson went from the Tigers to the, you know, when he's on the Tigers, he was kind of a gap-to-gap hitter. I think he led the league in triples 1 year. Then he went to the Yankees and he was like, wait, I can just, you know, just try and
43 homers, yank 41 everything, home runs.
You know, and he became a home run hitter. And I do wonder if, like, depending on a different ballpark, if, you know, we've seen players do this, Brian Dozier being the prime example, basically like, you know what, I'm just going to try and pull everything. If Hosmer could become the home run hitter people kind of expected him to be. But as we know, Kauffman Stadium might be the worst home run hitting park in baseball.
I will buy that. I think that's hurt him. I agree with that.
So I'm not saying he can do it, but I'm curious if he tried to reinvent himself as a hitter, you know, if he went to a different park, what that might look like.
Before we move on, I want to talk about Eric Hosmer's defense. And this is kind of like a larger picture about where we're going to go with StatCast defense. If you look at his reputation, he won Gold Gloves 2013, 2014, and 2015. 3 years in a row, he won the Gold Glove Award. But if you look at over the last four seasons, you know, defensive runs saved, plus one. So basically average, 43 first baseman played at least 1,000 innings over the last 4 years. He's 23rd. So, you know, middle of the pack. Our friend August Fagerstrom last summer at Fangraphs wrote about this. He dug deep. He looked at every play he could find. And he basically came up with the takeaway that the advanced numbers, the traditional numbers, the video scouts all say the same exact thing. He's a perfectly ordinary defensive first baseman. And I think that makes sense, right? He's average, but the perception there is he wins Gold Gloves. So he's really good. How do we measure first base defense, I guess, is kind of the big takeaway.
It's tough. And he's a good example. Going back to what I was saying before about the speed, is that he definitely looks more athletic than your average first baseman. I think that definitely helped him in the eye test. You know, he just seems, and he will occasionally make sort of some of these athletic plays that, you know, maybe some of the first basemen would never make, and that kind of, you know, enhances his, you know, the perception of him. You know, the other play that enhances the perception of him speaks to his speed is that play in the World Series, you know, his dash from third base against the Mets. There's not another first baseman in baseball who takes that chance and sprints home.
How different is his perception if Lucas Duda makes a better throw?
It's very different. But, those another free agent first baseman next year.
Yeah, exactly right. But I'm interested. We're not there yet with StatCast, but in the near future, we're going to be able to do a better job of measuring throw accuracy. And you think about that from, you know, like the shortstop's perspective. But I'm interested in about it from the first baseman's perspective. Like, how many good, like, is he working with infielders who make it easy on him? You know, or does he have infielders who bounce everything in the dirt, make it really difficult on him? I think that's kind of an interesting way to view how we might better measure first base defense going forward, because we don't do a great job of that right now.
For sure. And then not only that, but also the ability to kind of not just balls in the dirt, but being able to stay on the bag on high throws or wide throws, and sort of having the, you know, being flexible enough to sort of make those plays. Usually we just think about scoops in the dirt,
right?
But like, there's more to it, you know, there's a lot more to it than just that. It's, you know, it's there's different types of inaccurate throws beyond just throws in the dirt.
Right. And we're not there yet, but we will be. And it'd be interested to see if Eric Hosmer ends up looking differently. So we're going to move on from that to what I think was a very interesting discussion about arbitration. But before we do that, a very quick promotion for one of our other podcasts here at MLB.com. The Cut Forecast is the podcast from the staff of MLB.com's Cut Four section, which focuses on the lighter side of baseball to make you laugh. It's actually really interesting. This week's episode is going to be fantastic because our hosts, Gemma Canico and Dakota Gardner, will interview Twins.com beat writer Rhett Bollinger on the subject of vomit. That's right. It is baseball related because Minnesota reliever Ryan O'Rourke gets sick before every single game. So if you're interested in that, and why wouldn't you be, search Cut Forecast, CUT number 4, CAST, in iTunes or wherever else. It's a super interesting show. I've been on it. I enjoy it.
May I propose a nickname for Ryan O'Rourke?
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait.
Puke Lelouch.
Wait, you've been hanging on to that one for a while?
You heard it here first.
You should be on the Cut Forecast talking about this.
You heard it here first, folks.
Speaking of vomit, the arbitration process. My best segue I think we've ever had. If you've been paying attention over the last couple of days, you know that Dellin Betances and the Yankees got into somewhat of a controversy because Dellin Betances went into arbitration asking for $5 million. The Yankees offered $3 million, and the Yankees won. And then there were some comments on both sides that got a little bit out of hand, I think. So, setting aside for the fact, you know, how ugly that got, I think this really opens the door into a larger conversation about what arbitration actually does for players.
Yeah,
right?
the quick overview for those who are a little less familiar is basically what happens is the team and, you know, they exchange figures at a certain date if they haven't come to an agreement for that year. And the basically players can go through arbitration three times. We'll forget about Super Twos for now. 3 years. After the third year, after the fourth year, and after the fifth year. And basically the team and the player exchange figures and they go to arbitration. They each give, I think it's an hour presentation to a panel of arbiters. And then the arbiters have to decide one number or the other. There's no, they can't split the baby. So the team, if it's, you know, in this case, the team said 3 million, but Tanta said 5 million. So the arbiters had to choose one of those two numbers. And a big part of the arbitration process is comparable players. And you say like, okay, well, you know, there's precedent because another reliever got X amount based on, and a lot of the times in the case of relievers where it gets messy is saves.
Right.
And this is where it got messy with Betances.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, Betances is without question an elite reliever. You know, I ranked him as the number five reliever in baseball a couple weeks ago on MLB Network. But, you know, if you look at the numbers over the last 3 years, he is the most innings pitched of any reliever. He has the highest WAR of any reliever. And while I don't love WAR for relievers, that still directionally tells you he's been really good. 193 ERA, a 197 fielding independent pitching, the third highest strikeout percentage behind Chapman and Miller. He is indisputably one of the best relief pitchers in baseball. Whether or not saves matter at all. But see, that's kind of the problem is he's going to make $3 million this year. Other guys are earning $3 million this upcoming season. Andres Blanco, Jason Grilly, J.P. Howell, Tyler Flowers. Like, these are not really stars of the game. This really shows you that if you have not made it to free agency, you're kind of limited by how the arbitration process works. So that's not really going to change, but I do think the way that we can approach some of these players will change, right? Because players have said this for years. The process is archaic. These are not baseball people who are the arbiters. They're in some cases lawyers. I mean, they're smart, intelligent people. They're not really baseball people. They're still dealing with stats from like 35 years ago.
Well, it's not even just, you know, it's not even just they may, whether or not they're baseball people or not. You know, lawyers deal in precedent. So, you know, if someone says to them, okay, here's how the process works. Here's how, you know, here's how generally these decisions are made. They're going to say, okay, well, like, you know, sounds like, you know, we're supposed to weigh saves heavily. You know, they're not told like, oh, we should, you know, we should weigh FIP or
right.
spin rate or whatever. Not that thing, you know, that should be the factor. But I'm just saying like they have an expectation of how they're supposed to rule. And saves certainly cloud the discussion when it comes to reliever. The best example I found this year is Sam Dyson, who is also going through arbitration for the first time. He didn't go to arbitration, but he settled with the Rangers for $3.8 million. And which just goes to show that the Rangers were prepared, you know, probably to go to a hearing and knew they were going to have to pay, you know, somewhere in the $4 million range for Sam Dyson. Sam Dyson had 38 saves last year, but in no way is he comparable to Dellin Betances in terms of dominance or effectiveness. But he had the saves, so he's going to earn more, basically, even though they're in the exact essentially the same service class.
So the goal should be to change the arbitration process so that it's not based on, you know, saves and batting average and RBIs or whatever the case may be. Now, how do you do that? I feel like there's a couple of really good ideas out there, and I know you've got some yourself. You know, it could be as simple as getting baseball people, you know, on that panel who will look at some of this, and whether that's replacing the arbiters or just supplementing them, you know, either way is fine. Or it could be you know, getting rid of that panel entirely, because there have been stories where team executives and agents say there is nothing in the entire baseball universe that's more of a time suck for them than just trying to prepare for these arguments over what's really not a great deal of money. So maybe we get rid of the panel entirely and we kind of work towards some sort of formula. Right? Or it's basically there's X amount of money in the pool for players, you know, with this amount of service time, and we're going to rank them based on the formula we come up with, and that's how they get paid for this year. Wouldn't that make things so much easier? And then we could avoid all these arguments back and forth.
But is it a pool per team, or is it like all the teams have a collective pool?
Yeah, I think if you have, I don't know, let's say 100 players who have the service time between 3 and 4 years, there is X amount of money set aside to pay for them, because we already kind of know the ranges that they're going to be in. And then you could say, well, Dellin Betances is the best player of this pool, and the best player is going to get 10% of the entire pool, you know, and goes down, and then the worst player gets 2%. I don't know what the numbers would actually be, but maybe that makes things simpler and you change it, you know, every time there's a new CBI.
It's certainly, you know, the some sort of data-driven model makes sense in theory. I mean, as you said, the amount of preparation that goes into these hearings, and the fact that it's kind of funny the amount of, when you think about it, when it's like, you know, what teams spend on players, and then they're fighting tooth and nail for basically, you know, for essentially you know, $1 million either way on Donovan Dunn's.
And what I saw, I can't remember who wrote it, but somebody interviewed an arbiter where he was basically like, we only get 24 hours to review and decide. I not only can I not, you know, understand all this stuff, I don't even read it. Like, a lot of it's just wasted work because there's just not time to go through it all.
Yeah, I mean, the one idea I had, and this is actually something that might fit more with rethinking the first 3 years of player control when players are basically, their salaries are set, is like, but creating tiers so that, like, you know, you basically, instead of, you know, sort of arguing for a certain dollar amount, we basically say, okay, you know, in each service class, let's say, you know, 3+, which Betances was, you know, and relievers, we say there are 5 tiers, you know, but for example, and I'm just making this up, tier 1 gets $1 million, 2 million, 3, 4, 5 million. And so you argue, like, what tier you're in. And maybe, at least, I think that doing something like that may allow us to sort of reset our calibration, because right now so much of it is set on comparable players. So if we reset the way the payment system is, and we wouldn't have to rely on, you know, the comps from recent years to sort of decide exactly what the dollar amount should be.
Yeah, but how would you set those tiers, right? Because it would have to be based on more advanced stats. I think this is probably the only place in the baseball world where saves really still matter. You know, and the Yankees themselves have proven it doesn't. They're the ones who gave Andrew Miller that big contract when I think he had one career save at the time.
Although, I mean, on the football side argument, that it's still half of what Kenley Jansen and Roland Chapman got this year.
For free agency, you mean?
Yes. Like, Miller got 4 for, like, 36.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, so, like...
was, like, 2 or 3 years ago now. I think things have changed.
Things have changed. But, yes, to your point, yes. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, the Indians, for example, they let Cody Allen save games. But everyone knows...
Andrew Miller's the man.
And Andrew Miller's better, you know? So, the most famous example I can think of is the 2007 Indians, who let Joe Borowski get 45 saves when they had... Rafael Perez and I can't remember who the other guy was.
I don't know, but it's a good show because we got to talk about Joe Borowski.
And Rafael Betancourt, who each had ERAs below 2 and more than a strikeout per inning.
Right. I mean, I think the entire baseball world understands that saves do not make for a good pitcher. Saves are opportunity-based. So if we can figure out a way to compensate guys based on the outs they actually get, you know, rather than the positions that their teams put them in, because you need to get into sort of, you know, uncertain moral boundaries there because the teams aren't letting them get save opportunities.
But there's also the philosophical argument about arbitrations. Like, should you know, if we bring more advanced things, let's we start to bring StatCast into, let's say, for
which
example,
we should.
But, like, should you bring something like barrels, for example, into an arbitration argument when it may not necessarily be result based? Like, shouldn't the discussion really be about results?
No, I agree with you on that. But there are still better stats to talk about results instead of process, even though you're right. In a large part, we are trying to get to more of a process-based outcome than a results-based outcome. I guess the takeaway here is I'm super glad I never have to go through the arbitration process because just everything about it sounds awful.
Yeah, it's not one of the prettier parts of the offseason. And also, it's like it ends up being a big story when in the grand scheme of things, it seems like it really shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be. So, you know, we're just talking about rethinking how to grade pitchers. And I think there's a larger conversation we can get into here. It's just rethinking how to use pitchers. You know, if you think about a starting rotation, the ideal would be 5 guys who throw 220 innings a year, and that's your entire starting rotation. That just about never, ever happens. I think a big part of why the Cubs were so successful last year is they basically did have that. They had 5 guys who made 152 of their 162 starts. That's so rare that that ever happens, you know? And they don't really have a ton of starting pitching depth. The fact that those guys stayed healthy was a big thing for them. It's not really how it works anymore. It's less about, you know, which 5 guys are going to start for me all year long. And it's more about how do I get about 920 innings, which was the team average last year, from my starting pitchers. Whether that's 5 pitchers, that's great. Maybe it's 8. Sometimes it's 10. But I think there's some new ways to kind of go about that. You know, so the Dodgers are a great example because they've got a ton of starting pitching depth. And with the 10-day DL now, you're probably going to see teams kind of moving pitchers on and off that DL to get fresher guys in. It's no longer going to be, well, you know, you had an unsuccessful year because you were on the DL 3 times. It's probably better that than wasting a spot for 9 days if you have someone fresh and healthy to step in.
Yeah, I think that the 10-day DL is going to have a much larger impact on the season than might have been predicted when it was implemented for this exact reason. Particularly with pitchers, it's really not hard to go without a starter for 10 days. And it's also not hard to sort of be like, he's got a sore arm, maybe he should go on the DL. Because, like, pitchers basically will tell you they're never 100%.
Yeah, after the second week of the season, everyone's got some sort of
injury. So, like, it's, you know, with these teams that have this depth, even some of the teams that don't have this depth, there's, like, little reason not to if you just want to skip a start, particularly if you have an off day baked in. Really, you could, if you have an off day, you literally skip one start with a DL
right.
trip.
It's exactly right. So there are three teams I kind of want to touch on here. The first one, as I said, is the Dodgers. Rich Hill has been fantastic when he's healthy, but he's almost never healthy. Over the last nine seasons, eight trips to the disabled list, he's thrown fewer than 300 innings. And I think, you know, you sign him with the expectation he will miss starts. Like, you cannot pencil him in for 30 starts. It's just not going to happen. If you get 20 starts from him in 140 innings or so, and they're really good starts, you're probably happy with that. You don't say, well, he was on the disabled list twice.
Yeah.
Because you set that expectation. But if you look at the Dodgers rotation, obviously they have Kershaw, but they also have Kenta Maeda, Kazmir, Urias, McCarthy, Ryu maybe, Brock Stewart, Alex Wood, Ross Stripling. They have a lot of guys who could have some success. And what's interesting about that is if you have them step in at the right point, you could really avoid some of, let's say, the lesser starts from these guys. For example, Kenta Maeda's best pitch is his slider. That slider velocity decreased pretty significantly as last year went on. And, you know, he came from a situation before where he's used to pitching on 5 days rest. So when he did that last year in 13 starts, 301 ERA, a 586 OPS. When he went on 4 days rest last year, also 13 starts, a 397 ERA, a 728 OPS. Maybe you can work your rotation so that he gets that extra day rest. Maybe you can have Scott Kazmir make 10 good starts as opposed to 25 questionable starts. You get the good ones, then you get them out of the way for somebody else. I think a smart team can really take advantage of something like this.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's the new wave of, I think it's sort of the next, you know, I think that the last few years, that sort of the next frontier had been kind of, I think, shifting infielders and outfielders. And I think that as sort of that was like the new wave of kind of, you know, analytics being implied on the field. And I think that starting pitcher usage in this mold is going to be sort of the next plateau. And the next team that, you know, I know you mentioned when I'm talking about the Padres, and I think they're a perfect,
they're a laboratory.
They're a perfect laboratory because, let's be honest, they're not going to be very good, and they don't have any really standout pitchers.
Before I name them, I would like the listeners of our show to just take a brief second and try to name the five best Padres starting pitchers in your head, and I think it might actually be tougher than you think. Now, I'll give you the answers right here in any order you prefer. Jared Cosart, Luis Perdomo.
Luis Perdomo is one of the lowest two-seam spin rates in baseball. Could be a sneaky pickup for deep fantasy leagues.
Christian Friedrich, Julius Chassin, and Jared Weaver. Now, Jared Weaver to the Padres makes perfect sense, although I do have to point out, he almost signed with the Reds. Jared Weaver, as a flyball pitcher in that ballpark, would have been something to see. I am excited for Jared Weaver, no, in the NL West, to make his first career start at Coors Field. He's never done it before, but I'm super excited about that. The point, honestly, is those five guys are not going to last the entire season in the rotation. You're also going to see Clayton Richard, Paul Clemens, Trevor Cahill, Zach Lee, Tyrell Jenkins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point of bringing up the Padres is that our AJ Cassavell, who's the Padres beat writer, wrote a really interesting story about a potential plan that the manager talked about. They might try to go through the opposing lineup once with a certain starting pitcher, and then get him out of there. Maybe with a guy with a different handedness, so from a lefty to a righty. And the goal is to get rid of any platoon advantages and make the other manager kind of go through his bench earlier than he wants to. And I think that's a fantastic idea. I mean, we know that pitchers are less effective the more they go through the lineup. None of these guys can be counted on to go 7 or 8 innings anyway. Why not be inventive? This is the perfect situation for this.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, the one time the lineup seems, because it seems like really the third time for the lineup is when you really start to see the fall off. So it feels like you could maybe go through two times the lineup, but hey, you want to try once and see if the platoon change makes a difference while being, you know, maybe aggressive use of the DL. More power to you.
This is how we get to what Brian Kenny calls bullpenning. We get away from expecting a starter to go 7 or 8 innings. You know, we can say, we want, you know, 3 1/3 good innings from you. And if that's kind of the end of your effectiveness and you're going to decline after that, great. Don't worry about it. We'll get you out of there. This kind of goes back to the arbitration issue, because if you do that, these guys are not going to pick up wins. And that in arbitration, you still get paid somewhat on wins. It all kind of comes back together. We have to figure out a better way to pay pitchers. It can't be based on wins, because they're just not going to be as many in years to come.
And there aren't as many as it is now, but there'll even be fewer if teams start using their bullpens in this manner.
I think another interesting example is the Yankees, and I bring them up because Joel Sherman kind of wrote about this in the New York Post, and that's a very, you know, he's more of a traditional writer who, you know, wouldn't necessarily kind of be willing to quote-unquote kill the win, but that's pretty much what he said. He's like, forget about trying to push a starter through 5 innings before he qualifies the win. It's not about pitcher individual wins. It's about getting the team to 90 team wins. And I just kind of love that there's a more quote-unquote traditional outlet that's starting to think like this as well. And it makes sense for the Yankees too. Tanaka's really good, but you know, you can never really count on that elbow. Sabathia and Pineda, they have their moments, but I don't think you can count on either of them either. And then beyond them, Luis Severino, Chad Green, Brian Mitchell. I mean, some of these guys may end up being turned into like 90 or 100 inning relievers as opposed to starters. Get them out after four innings and get these guys in for two or three more.
Well, I think that's probably going to be the biggest way that teams get players to buy in is getting guys coming back from injury. Like, to me, this is like the perfect thing for guys coming back. Imagine if the Nationals had tried to do this that year when Strasburg came back and they ended up shutting him down. Like, granted, if they had the, it's easier to do with the 10-day DL, but like, or the, you know, the Mets with Matt Harvey a couple years ago when they had that whole controversy where they might shut him down. Like, they, you know, it's the same thing where like if they had some, if they had this thought process in place, where like, you know what, we're going to skip starts or maybe just take him out after two times to the inning to order no matter what, knowing that we can maybe like then skip a start and bring him back. You know, players might say, okay, like I see that like they actually have my long-term,
right,
you know, health in mind. And the, it's sort of a flip side to sort of digress a bit to the Betances issue is that like one of the biggest issues in the arbitration process, I think that sort of the relievers end up being the biggest losers for a variety of reasons. And I think Betances, for example, you mentioned he's like the most innings pitched of any reliever because like, you know, as Betances is a rare talent. That said, their relievers are easier to find and is easier to replenish if you can find a live arm. So teams are less worried about kind of like churning through them. I think back to, Johnny Venters, who for like 2 years with the Braves was like maybe the best, you know, the short list of best relievers in baseball. Our friend Fernando Perez, who's done some MLB Plus games, says he is the nastiest pitcher he's ever faced. But basically, you know, he had like 90 appearances, maybe not 90 appearances, but like led the league in appearances over a 2 year span, yeah, blew out his arm
three times,
never got to arbitration, I don't think, never really got quote unquote paid. But, you know, Braves were kind of aware of the fact that like they were very good at kind of generating new relievers. Starting pitchers is a little bit different, so teams may have their long-term health in mind and maybe more willing with a Luis Severino to say, you know what, we're going to try and experiment with you a little bit, finding the right role for you, getting you 4 or 5 inning stints as opposed to trying to say, oh, you're only going to be a reliever or you're only going
to
be a starter.
Well, it does kind of go back to stats though, right? Because let's say a guy like Adam Warren, for example, who's been a quote-unquote swingman, which I think is a good way to describe this. What if you say to Adam Warren, you're gonna get into 30 games this year. We're going to have you pitch, you know, 3 1/3 innings each time. So you'll have 30 games, about 100 innings, and we expect that you're going to have 0 saves and go 4-3. You know, it's like that could be an extremely valuable pitcher. But how do you quantify that in a way, you know, that's going to impress the arbitration board or a team in free agency? I think that's the next big question. We just don't have the answer to it yet because that's how this is going to go.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And I think that, you know, if we had this sort of, you know, metrics-based arbitration engine that you proposed, it would solve some of these issues.
It all comes completely full circle. That's our show for this week. I am Mike Petriello. Matt Myers over here. Thank you for listening to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. We will catch you next week.